Good evening and welcome. We're working in the chapter called Equality and the Annihilation of Ego. This is chapter 9. In the first section, Yoga of Divine Works and the Synthesis of Yoga. We got a couple of pages into the chapter last time before we stopped. The idea of equality is something very close to the development of the Yoga of Works in the Bhagavad Gita. There it is paired with the idea of work itself, that equality, an equal receptivity to all events, whether they are positive or negative, is keyed to action. The principal verse in which this occurs is in the second chapter, it's the 48th shloka, and Krishna insists that it be done in the web of life, that one establish this equality in life. It isn't the first time, of course, that the term samatvam or samatha has occurred in Indian spiritual literature. It goes all the way back. The word sama, same, occurs all the way back into the earliest annals of recorded Sanskrit literature, no doubt. But it begins to take on a spiritual significance in the Shatapatha Brahmana, which is very old and predates by hundreds, if not thousands of years, the Bhagavad Gita. Also, we find the term used in Buddhism. Buddha referred to samatam and vipassana as the two things that could take you to enlightenment. But of course, in his discipline, it is a movement away from engagement in the world, which is considered, he himself having renounced the world, shaven his head, so to say, and put on the ochre robe, and lived a life as a renunciant, a shramana. So the Gita reverses that, insists on the same inner spiritual freedom, the same equality to all events, pro or con, but engaged in the world, doing works as a conscious offering to that to whom is the goal, that is the Supreme Being, as we come to know it in the Gita, the Purushottama, the Supreme Person, who stands in the center of all things, who in fact holds within his own being all the cosmic realms, not simply the realm of human life, not simply the globe that we know and walk upon, but all the worlds teeming with vital beings, with gods. Everything exists within the compass of this one Supreme Person. And that Supreme Person is the real origin of all work. And to be identified with that Supreme Person is a goal of the yoga, of the Gita, and uses these three methods, works, knowledge, and love, to unite the person with that Supreme. The insistence that Sri Aurobindo brings here in this section, of course, is on knowledge and love being placed in the field of work, that consecration, the making sacred of all oneself and all one's doings in a conscious giving to the Supreme is what constitutes that action. To be able to do it perfectly means to transcend, to excuse oneself from the limitation of ego and to live in full complementariness with that Supreme. In perception, in will, in actual vibrational work, So we begin the renunciation of attachment to the work and its fruit is the beginning of a wide movement towards an absolute equality in the mind and soul, which must become all-enveloping if we are to be perfect in the spirit. For the worship of the Master of Works demands a clear recognition and glad acknowledgement of him in ourselves, in all things, and in all happenings. Now, if we think that this occurs only in the Gita, that this is the only document, well, earlier Upanishads also speak in similar vein, the Isha Upanishad, of course, but also the Shvetashvatara Upanishad. Equality is the sign of this adoration. It is the soul's ground on which true sacrifice and worship can be done. And for this, we can go not only to chapter 2, shloka 48, but also chapter 2, shloka 15. The Lord is there equally in all beings. We have to make no essential distinctions between ourselves and others, the wise and the ignorant, friend and enemy, man and animal, the saint and the sinner. We must hate none, despise none, be repelled by none, for in all we have to see the one disguised or manifested at his pleasure. He is a little revealed in one or more revealed in another, or concealed and wholly distorted in others, according to his will and his knowledge of what is best for that which he intends to become in form in them and to do in works in their nature. This is, again, redolent of what Sri Aurobindo wrote in the book, The Mother. All is ourself, one self that has taken many shapes. Hatred and disliking and scorn and repulsion, clinging and attachment and preference are natural, necessary, inevitable at a certain stage. They attend upon or they help to make and maintain nature's choice in us. But to the karma yogin, they are a survival, a stumbling block, a process of the ignorance, and as he progresses, they fall away from his nature. The child's soul needs them for its growth, but they drop from an adult in the divine culture. In the God nature to which we have to rise, there can be an adamantine, even a destructive severity, but not hatred, a divine irony, but not scorn, a calm, clear seeing and forceful rejection, but not repulsion and dislike. Even what we have to destroy, we must not abhor or fail to recognize as a disguised and temporary movement of the eternal. Sri Aurobindo noted in his conversations, his evening talks that were recorded by Purani and others, that even this samatha that would be established at the level of the mind is not the real samatha that he aimed at. His insight was that to establish the true spiritual equality meant bringing down the imperative supermind into mind, life, and body here. That it can't simply be a mental equality, but that all of our being has to be equal. A subtle equality in the mind, surely, a perception of the one in all things, but vibrationally in the prana, the same thing. In the emotions, the same thing. In our physical experience of life, the same thing. He spoke about this in 1923. It would be another 3 years before he could establish that kind of perfect equality in the physical tissues of his body. but he saw it as a goal even then. And on this topic, by the way, he noted that even when Durga has to slay the Rakshasas, that there must be an equality in her. She doesn't slay from hatred or repugnance. She slays because it is the thing to be done. And you see, when you go to Mamallapuram, you know, and you look at the great statue, where the relief of she is Durga, about to slay Mahishasura, and all the demon horde are falling back as she prepares a smaller being in scope and size to strike them down, and they begin to see the enormity of what's coming to them. That rather than fierceness on her face, her eyes are directed upwards. She's calling the force of what she is above, of her transcendent power, into being as she gets ready to draw the bow and release the arrow to destroy the creature. She does not abhor the Rakshasa. That too, like everything here, is an element of her own being. It is another child, but a wayward child that has to be corrected. And since all things are the one self in its manifestation, we shall have equality of soul towards the ugly and the beautiful, the maimed and the perfect, the noble and the vulgar, the pleasant and the unpleasant, the good and the evil. And this again is the Shvetashvatara Upanishad 4.4 and 5.13. I can go on citing and citing. Here also, there will be no hatred, scorn, and repulsion, but instead the equal eye that sees all things in their real character and their appointed place. For we shall know that all things express or disguise, develop or distort as best they can, or with whatever defect they must, under the circumstances intended for them, in the way possible to the immediate status or function or evolution of their nature, some truth or fact, some energy or potential of the divine necessary by its presence in the progressive manifestation, both to the whole of the present sum of things, and for the perfection of the ultimate result. That truth is what we must seek and discover behind the transitory expression. Undeterred by appearances, by the deficiencies or the disfigurements of the expression, we can then worship the divine forever unsullied, pure, beautiful, and perfect behind his masks. All indeed has to be changed. Not ugliness accepted, but divine beauty. Not imperfection taken as our resting place, but perfection striven after. The supreme good made the universal aim, and not evil. But what we do has to be done with a spiritual understanding and knowledge, and it is a divine good, beauty, perfection, pleasure that has to be followed after, not the human standards of these things. If we have not equality, it is a sign that we are still pursued by the ignorance. We shall truly understand nothing, and it is more than likely that we shall destroy the old imperfection only to create another. For we are substituting the appreciations of our human mind and desire soul for the divine values. So we see again, he stresses here an equal-souled action based on a perception of the one in all things. And if you remember his poem, Despair on the Staircase, he speaks of the fur-footed Brahman as he regards the cat. Recognizing even here, this is Brahman. in a fur-footed disguise. It must be regarded as so. Equality does not mean a fresh ignorance or blindness. It does not call for and need not initiate a grayness of vision and a blotting out of all hues. Difference is there, variation of expression is there, and this variation we shall appreciate far more justly than we could when the eye was clouded by a partial and erring love and hate, admiration and scorn, sympathy and antipathy, attraction and repulsion. But behind the variation, we shall always see the complete and immutable who dwells within it, and we shall feel, know, or at least, if it is hidden from us, trust in the wise purpose and divine necessity of the particular manifestation, whether it appear to our human standards harmonious and perfect, or crude and unfinished, or even false and evil. Purnam. Purnam madha, purnam idam. That is full, this is full. And so too, we shall have the same equality of mind and soul towards all happenings, painful or pleasurable, defeat and success, honor and disgrace, good repute and ill repute, good fortune and evil fortune. For in all happenings we shall see the will of the master of all works and results, and a step in the evolving expression of the divine. He manifests himself to those who have the inner eye that sees, in forces and their play and results, as well as in things and in creatures. All things move towards a divine event. Each experience, suffering and want, no less than joy and satisfaction, is a necessary link in the carrying out of a universal movement, which it is our business to understand and second. To revolt, to condemn, to cry out is the impulse of our unchastened and ignorant instincts. Revolt, like everything else, has its uses in the play and is even necessary, helpful, decreed for the divine development in its own time and stage. But the movement of an ignorant rebellion belongs to the stage of the soul's childhood or to its raw adolescence. The ripened soul does not cry out, but accepts or toils to improve and perfect, does not revolt inwardly, but labors to obey and fulfill and transfigure. Therefore, we shall receive all things with an equal soul from the hands of the Master. Failure we shall admit as a passage as calmly as success until the hour of the divine victory arrives. Our souls and minds and bodies will remain unshaken by acutest sorrow and suffering and pain if in the divine dispensation they come to us, unoverpowered by intensest joy and pleasure. Thus, supremely balanced, we shall continue steadily on our way, meeting all things with an equal calm until we are ready for a more exalted status and can enter into the supreme and universal Ananda. So, Sri Aurobindo, again in his conversations with his disciples in the early days, maybe even before the ashram formed, and certainly after it formed, spoke of this samatha, this equality, as the very basis of peace, but a peace that is full of power. So peace is the basis of our action, but samatha is a greater achievement than peace. He noted that he did not begin with that fullness of realization, that the equality that he had with his earliest realization in 1908, he began to see was imperfect. He thought that he had a firm and final equality, but he was led to see more and more that there was an egoistic preference that remained here or there in his being, and finally was able to extinguish it all the way down into the subconscious. He said it is almost endless where this goes. We think that we've conquered it when we get rid of preference in the mind, and he says it persists. And that spiritual realization has to be pressed into every level of the being. One might be essentially free. One might be essentially liberated. But the perfection that he demands for an integral yoga means that that equality has to be established throughout the nature. Very difficult. I think we can go a little farther. This equality cannot come except by a protracted ordeal and patient self-discipline. So this is yoga. Equality is what establishes yoga. So long as desire is strong, equality cannot come at all except in periods of quiescence and the fatigue of desire. And it is then more likely to be an inert indifference or desire's recoil from itself than the true calm and the positive spiritual oneness. To go back to the first part of that statement, self-government is what is yoga. Yoga means a yoking of all the sense equipment, of all the mind, of all the heart, of all the being, as if you're putting them into a team that will carry the soul towards a goal. That's why the Gita and other spiritual literature has often referred to the wild horses that you have to yoke together to pull the wagon successfully forward to reach the destination, which is spiritual liberty. That kind of equality cannot come if you don't have that kind of self-government. You can't just run wild and have one part of your being be convinced that it's got establishment in that spirit. It's the whole being, to Sri Aurobindo, that has to be governed. Yoga is a wholesale achievement. Moreover, he writes, this discipline or this growth into equality of spirit has its necessary epochs and stages. Ordinarily, we have to begin with a period of endurance, for we must learn to confront, to suffer, and to assimilate all contacts. Each fiber in us must be taught not to wince away from that which pains and repels, and not to run eagerly towards that which pleases and attracts, but rather to accept, to face, to bear, and to conquer. All touches we must be strong to bear, not only those that are proper and personal to us, but those born of our sympathy or our conflict with the worlds around, above or below us, and with their peoples. We shall endure tranquilly the action and impact on us of men and things and forces, the pressure of the gods and the assaults of titans. We shall face and engulf in the unstirred seas of our spirit all that can possibly come to us down the ways of the soul's infinite experience. This is the stoical period of the preparation of equality, its most elementary and yet its heroic age. This is, of course, titiksha, the power to endure. You begin by learning to tolerate, to bear. It builds into endurance. Eventually, it can become equality. So, like, you bear the cold, you bear the heat. You learn to endure, to last through it. And finally, it has no impact on you anymore. But, he writes, this steadfast endurance of the flesh and heart and mind must be reinforced by a sustained sense of spiritual submission to a divine will. This living clay must yield not only with a stern or courageous acquiescence, but with knowledge or with resignation, even in suffering, to the touch of the divine hand that is preparing its perfection. Bhagavad Gita, again, chapter 2, shloka 14. A sage, a devout, or even a tender stoicism of the God lover is possible. And these are better than the merely pagan self-reliant endurance which may lend itself to a too great hardening of the vessel of God. For this kind prepares the strength that is capable of wisdom and of love. Its tranquility is a deeply moved calm that passes easily into bliss. The gain of this period of resignation and endurance is the soul's strength equal to all shocks and contacts. There is next a period of high-seated impartiality and indifference, in which the soul becomes free from exaltation and depression and escapes from the snare of the eagerness of joy as from the dark net of the pangs of grief and suffering. All things and persons and forces, all thoughts and feelings and sensations and actions, one's own, no less than those of others, are regarded from above by a spirit that remains intact and immutable and is not disturbed by these things. And he'll cite it in a minute, Udasina. This is the philosophic period of the preparation of equality, a wide and august movement. But indifference must not settle into an inert turning away from action and experience. It must not be an aversion born of weariness, disgust, and distaste, a recoil of disappointed or satiated desire, the sullenness of a baffled and dissatisfied egoism forced back from its passionate aims. These recoils come inevitably in the unripe soul and may in some way help the progress by a discouragement of the eager, desire-driven vital nature, but they are not the perfection towards which we labor. The indifference or the impartiality that we must seek after is a calm superiority or of the high-seated soul above the contacts of things. Udasina, seated above, looking down from the akshara purusha at the movements of the kshara purusha. It regards and accepts or rejects them, but is not moved in the rejection and is not subjected by the acceptance. It begins to feel itself near, kin to, one with a silent self in spirit, self-existent and separate from the workings of nature, which it supports and makes possible, part of or merged in the motionless, calm reality that transcends the motion and action of the universe. The gain of this period of high transcendence is the soul's peace, unrocked and unshaken by the pleasant ripplings or by the tempestuous waves and billows of the world's movement. Again, that Udasina, being seated above in the Akshara Purusha, the unmoved peace of the silent self. If we can pass through these two stages of the interchange without being arrested or fixed in either, we are admitted to a greater divine equality which is capable of a spiritual ardor and tranquil passion of delight, a rapturous, all-understanding and all-possessing equality of the perfected soul, an intense and even wideness and fullness of its being, embracing all things. This is an invitation to move beyond, you see, this Akshara Purusha poise, this state of liberation into the wide silent self, which nevertheless remains active in the world, into something even greater, with ananda and power at its base, and that, without saying it, he regards as the supramental. So this is that supreme poise of the supramental, the imperative supermind, as he calls it, which can impose upon the nature all the felicities of its own being. This is the supreme period, and the passage to it is through the joy of a total self-giving to the divine and to the universal mother. For strength is then crowned by a happy mastery, siddhi, fulfillment. Peace deepens into bliss. The possession of the divine calm is uplifted and made the ground for the possession of the divine movement. But if this greater perfection is to arrive, the soul's impartial high-seatedness, looking down from above on the flux of forms and personalities and movements and forces, must be modified and change into a new sense of strong and calm submission and a powerful and intense surrender. This is the Atma Samarpana, the self-giving, the submission of the soul, the offering of one's core being. This submission will be no longer a resigned acquiescence, but a glad acceptance. For there will be no sense of suffering or of the bearing of a burden or cross, sacrifice in the English sense of the term. Love and delight and the joy of self-giving will be its brilliant texture. And this surrender will be not only to a divine will, which we perceive and accept and obey, but to a divine wisdom in the will, which we recognize, and a divine love in it, which we feel and rapturously suffer. The wisdom and love of a supreme spirit and self of ourselves and all with which we can achieve a happy and perfect unity, samashti, the wider spiritual collectivity. A lonely power, peace and stillness is the last word of the philosophic equality of the sage. But the soul, in its integral experience, liberates itself from this self-created status and enters into the sea of a supreme and all-embracing ecstasy of the beginningless and endless beatitude of the eternal. Then we are at last capable of receiving all contacts with a blissful equality, because we feel in them the touch of the imperishable love and delight, the happiness absolute that hides ever in the heart of things. The gain of this culmination in a universal and equal rapture is the soul's delight and the opening gates of the bliss that is infinite, the joy that surpasses all understanding. So he's writing from the depths of his own rapturous realization of Ananda that has proceeded cascading from above, from overhead realms, all the way into the tissues of his very body. This is a record of his experience, cast into language to lead us forward in the practice of yoga. So I think here is where we'll put our bookmark for this evening.